Welcome, everyone, to this episode of Speaking of Translation. I'm Eve Baudou.
And I'm Corinne McKay. Thanks for joining us.
So in this episode, I have a very special guest who is Corinne. Yay, Corinne! So we're going to be interviewing Corinne today about a serious topic, which is her recent milestone of passing the Colorado State Court Interpreter Certification Exam for, wait for it, French. We thought this would be an interesting episode that would be helpful to any of our listeners who are also preparing for an interpreting exam, or even if you aren't interested in interpreting, really anybody who wants to advice on how to break a big goal down into manageable steps.
Yeah, thanks, Eve. So I'm excited to share this with our listeners. And first, I should say that when I started telling people that I passed the state court interpreting exam, many of them wondered whether this was an impulse kind of a thing. Like I decided a couple of months ago to just register for the exam and give it a shot and see how I did. And that actually could not be further from the truth. I was just too afraid to tell anyone about it during the years, literally years, that it took me. So I'll go into this in more detail in our interview. But I studied for the exam pretty intensively, like almost every day for about a year and a half leading up to it. So it was a pretty lengthy process.
You were such a good student.
I'm a nerd. So, yeah.
So let's start there, actually. So how did you get this idea to do this? And what was your initial goal in doing it?
Yeah, so I did some interpreting, a little bit of community and court interpreting, like more than 10 years ago, probably. Mm-hmm. So my daughter is now about to be 17, yikes. And I did some interpreting when she was really little, but then it ended up being not that compatible with mm-hmm. my schedule when she was really small. So mm-hmm. that was probably really more like 15 plus years ago. But I had always thought about going back to interpreting. And then at the 2017 ATA conference, I went to a presentation by an interpreter named Athena Matilski, and we'll put her website in the show notes. So she did a presentation on consecutive interpreting. And you know when you have those sort of like, you know, weird light bulb moments in life? And I sort of thought like, this really is now or never, because if I stew about it for another 10 years, I'm going to be 57. And then am I really going to do it? Which, by the way, people do. I mean, I'd say some of the people who went through the certification exam process with me in Colorado were at least in their 60s and maybe older. So by that, I don't mean to be dismissive
Super
of people who go, who go after that goal at an older age. But I just thought for myself personally, I don't know whether I would do this
Well, they probably were doing it then as a second career, that they had the language skills, and like you, who knows what they did in the background. But I mean, that they obviously, it seems like at that age, they were doing it as a second career. That's kind of cool.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but just be aware if this is something you want to do, that at least in Colorado, it's not going to be you and a room full of 24-year-olds at all.
The 24-year-olds, wait till you're 60. No, I'm kidding.
Yeah, right, exactly. So I did a private coaching with Athena with the goal of taking the state court interpreter exam, because even though I think my ultimate goal is to do conference interpreting, I felt that unless I was going to dive right into a master's in interpreting, which I may at some point do, but was not realistic right now because there are no programs in Colorado and my daughter's still in high school, so I can't really like pick up and move, that the first step would be to get some sort of credential. And I think in consultation with Athena, thought that the state court interpreter exam is probably the easiest interpreter certification exam to prepare for on your own. Like, well, I shouldn't say easiest, the most straightforward, because it's not easy in any way.
Well, not easy, but just compared to all of the different levels, that was the easiest one, but it's not easy.
Exactly. It's the most approachable, let's say that, to prepare for on your own. Because in most states, and I think throughout the episode today, I'm speaking about Colorado, but I think the process is similar in most states. Mm-hmm. You can retake only the section or sections that you failed. And as long as you pass all of the sections within 2 years, that's what I think most states require. then you can be certified.
Okay.
So for example, on the State Department exams, my impression is that if you fail, you have to pass all sections in one shot.
Every time.
Or you don't pass. Yeah.
Kind of like the foreign.
Whereas with
exam.
The, yeah, exactly. Right. Yeah. Exactly. Whereas on the state exams, there are three sections. You do sight translation in both directions, mm-hmm. consecutive interpreting in both directions, and then simultaneous into your non-English language only. Mm-hmm. But if you were to, so in Colorado, the minimum passing score is 70%. In some states, I don't believe in any state, it's higher than 70 to pass, although some states have what they call master distinction if mm-hmm. you get above an 80 on all sections. And some states only require 60, or there's some level of passing that only requires a 60. Like in Texas, you can get what's called a basic interpreting license if you get a 60.
Okay.
But the point being that what I felt was approachable for me is that if I failed one section, then for example, I could just take 6 months and focus on that one skill. Like mm-hmm. in Colorado, you have to wait 6 months before you retake it.
Okay.
But that I thought, for example, consecutive is always my worst. And I thought, you know, if I fail consecutive, then I'll just focus on consecutive for 6 months and retake that.
Well, what's nice, like you said, then it kind of makes you do it too, because you want to do it within the 2 year time frame.
Exactly.
But also then you can just focus on that's not, yeah, that was kind of a good strategy. So
yeah. So shout out to Athena for helping yeah. me figure out that strategy. So I did coaching with Athena for about a year. Then she herself went to a master's in conference interpreting program. So then I worked mostly on my own with Acebo Interpreter's Edge, which we'll talk about a little later.
So you mean at that point, or maybe now she isn't providing consulting services now, or?
So she does, but asynchronously. So when I say that I worked with her for the first year, we did live sessions over Zoom. So mm-hmm. we would meet like you were having a, you know, interpreting class, but on Zoom. Mm-hmm. But now, then when she started her master's in conference interpreting, she does still do that type of coaching, but only by sending recordings, you know, so that she can evaluate them at her convenience.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay. Just for people who might be interested, like we said, we'll post her information and okay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, she does French and Spanish. She's federally certified for Spanish and state certified for French, because you can't be federally certified for French.
Okay.
So yeah, I did one-on-one coaching with her for about a year. Then when she went to her master's in conference interpreting program, I sent her recordings and worked on my own with Acebo Interpreter's Edge, and then ultimately with the practice test for the actual exam.
Okay.
And I took the exam in April of this year, and much to my surprise, I passed all three sections on the first try, and I'm done.
Yeah. Yay. So it's good you have the strategy in place as backup and plan B, but you didn't need to use it. So
exactly. Awesome. Yeah, exactly.
So you talked a little bit about it, but can you give us a little more kind of structure about, at least in Colorado, what is the process for taking the court interpreter certification exam?
Sure. So basically, you're going to do three things, which is the orientation, the written exam, and the oral exam. And again, mm-hmm. every state is going to be different, but I think there are a lot of similarities. So you going to the orientation is just paying for it and sitting there. You know,
that's one out of three down.
Right. There is no assessment for the orientation. You just uh-huh. pay the fee and go for the day. So that's.
But I can understand that's kind of like. Like you have to have, they just want people like you, we talked about earlier, people think you just walk in and did it. They don't want people doing that.
Exactly.
They force you to go to the orientation is what you're saying.
Right. So in Colorado, you're actually required to go to the orientation before you can do anything else. And that's where they talk about, you know, what interpreting skills you need, what the certification process consists of, what the job actually consists of once you, are working. So that it was actually really helpful.
But I have a question about that, the orientation. Uh-huh. So that's not like in the same time frame. Was that 6 months earlier? Was that right then? Or when is the orientation part?
So I want to say that I should have written those dates down. I want to say approximately I did the orientation in maybe November, and then the written exam in about January, and then the oral exam in April.
Okay. And for you, like someone else might not have done that, but you actually kind of knew too because you had been working with your coach and everything. But she maybe didn't know, like, or whoever, if someone decides to work with or not to work with anyone, then you really learn specific stuff directly from the state of Colorado in that area.
Exactly. Yep, exactly.
Okay.
So then the written exam, I feel like it's a big variable because it's either going to be not that big a deal or really difficult, depending on whether you grew up and went to school in the US and know the US judicial system or not. So it's all in English. And at least in Colorado, it covers things like legal vocabulary and questions about the American legal system. So I'd say I studied about 10 hours for the written, and I got, I think, like a 97, above a 95 on the first try. But if I had to take that type of test about the French or Swiss legal system in French, that would have been way, way, way harder. And I think the main thing is don't assume that the written test is just a giveaway. Because I've talked to some, for example, non-native English speakers who didn't go to school here, who didn't study for the written and failed with like a 60. Because the thing is, I mean, just as an example, and I'm not saying that to be condescending, if I had to take that test about the Swiss legal system in French, I would definitely fail it if I
Just
didn't.
walking in off the street, yeah. I think
Yeah.
too that so when you said you prepared for that, did you, is there like special preparatory information, or you just kind of did a general kind of general refreshing for yourself on that, or was there specific prepared materials that are focused on that exam?
Yeah, so at the orientation, they gave us a binder of materials to study for the written exam. And one thing I'll reiterate later is like the Colorado Judicial Branch in their support for interpreters are amazing. I mean, they really, and I'm not saying that just to butter them up. It really is true that from talking to people who work in other states, the Colorado Judicial Branch is incredibly thorough and organized and really committed to recruiting and training high quality interpreters and paying professional rates and things like that. So we really have a great situation here in Colorado. And at the orientation, they gave us a binder of materials to study for the written test. And most of it, so they had a lot of legal vocabulary and then some sample questions for the written test. So mostly what I did was make flashcards of the court terms and the definitions of them and go over those. And I felt like that was pretty adequate. But I just think the written test is really hard to advise someone how difficult it's going to be and how much you need to study because it really depends on your sort of baseline level of knowledge of the, American legal system.
But also, like you said, this is specifically in the Colorado. It's on the state system, and then like it would be
Right.
in Texas on the state Texas states. It's not on the federal system
No,
at
no.
all.
Yeah,
So yeah.
it's
So
yeah.
right. Okay. So the stuff that they give you is really what you, as long as you study it, it's what you need
Yeah.
to prepare. Like you said, it depends on maybe you spent 10 hours, but someone who didn't grow up here would spend 40 or whatever.
Right, exactly.
Okay. So could you tell us a little bit more about how you prepared for the oral exam and what materials that you used or you find helpful for that particular piece of the exam? And throughout the US, of course, for lots of cultural reasons, historical reasons, Spanish is, one of the main languages. But how could you prepare for this kind of exam as someone in a language other than Spanish when there are less resources and also in the end less demand?
Yep. So I think one reason people that not that many people in languages other than Spanish, and you'll actually hear in court terminology, people use the term lots, languages other than Spanish, because Spanish is so dominant. But one of the reasons why there aren't that many people certified for languages other than Spanish is because there just are not that many prep materials. So, for example, I was never, if anyone has these, let me know. I was never able to find consecutive interpreting practice recordings where you have French and English in the same passage the way you do on the exam or in real life. I could only find stuff that was all someone speaking English and you go into French or French into speak and then you're going into English. So the thing I feel like that's really challenging is, you know, when people say, oh, but you could just look up like YouTube videos and, you know, with and put in like, you know, trial French. But here's the hard thing. I mean, this sounds basic, but it bears saying you're looking for materials in French or Italian or whatever language about the US legal system, not about the French system. So, for example, the French legal system does not even have the concepts of felony and misdemeanor. I mean, that's a basic example, but the point being, you need to know
How do you get that?
American legal terminology and American legal procedures in a language that has nothing to do with the US legal
Right, that
system.
doesn't have
And
that concept in its original language.
yes, that's the really, really hard thing. So the thing that's kind of funny is that it's sort of like back to, you know, say in, if you know people, you know, all of us have heard stories of people, say in the 90s, like before widespread use of the internet, that if they were studying for, let's say, the UN or State Department interpreting exams, they would do things like exchange bootleg cassette tapes of of UN speeches and things like that. And I actually think that if you're studying for a court interpreting exam in a language that Acebo Interpreter's Edge, which I'll talk about in a minute, doesn't exist for, it's kind of like going back to that.
Because there's really nothing.
Yeah. So, for example, in French, I really never found something like, you know, a compilation of 20 consecutive interpreting dialogues where one person's speaking English and the other person's speaking French, which for Spanish is not very hard to find at all. So the thing is that I think if you do a language other than Spanish, a really crucial ingredient is to work with a trainer who does your non-English language.
Because,
Like, if you are lucky, you find somebody like Athena who is certified and is a trainer. But at the very least, I would just ask people who are already certified in your language if they would work with you, you know, to help you prepare for the exam. So, as I said, and we'll put this in the show notes, sort of the gold standard of court interpreting home study materials is a program called Acebo Interpreter's Edge, which was developed by Holly Mickelson, which a lot of you guys probably have heard of her. She's like the, you know, goddess of court interpreter training. And now, actually, her son and daughter-in-law run Acebo. Yeah, right, the family business. So, but Holly developed all of these materials. And other than in Spanish, they have Cantonese, Mandarin, Korean, Vietnamese, Polish, Russian, Japanese, and Portuguese.
So they don't have French.
No. So, if you don't do one of those languages, then you buy what's called the generic edition, which is all in English. So it's the same materials, but you only interpret from English into your other language. Now, for me, that was actually okay because I'm not a native French speaker, so that was the direction that I needed to work on more anyway. But if you're a native speaker of the non-English language, that could be a little harder because maybe you need to work more on your into English. But for me, that's what I did, was bought the Acebo Interpreter's Edge generic edition and did that. So I also used tons of YouTube videos. The European Union has a lot of free resources for conference interpreters, which, even though it's not, you know, it doesn't have anything to do with US court interpreting, they're really great for improving your overall level of interpreting. So again, we'll put these in the show notes, but they
I
have
think I actually have that mentioned in my book. In my
Oh,
book,
great.
I think the interpreter, whatever you have the link to, but just so people know, that's one of the things, just for kind of just making yourself a little more fluid, whether you're studying for the interpreter's exams or not. I had that in my book, Maintaining Your Second Language, as a resource for people to use.
Yeah, and I actually should have said that at the beginning. If you are interested in taking any interpreting exam and you don't yet own Eve's book, Maintaining Your Second Language, no, for real, I went through a lot of things in your book just to help with my overall French speaking skills and, for that matter, interpreting skills.
Okay, good. That's good to know. Thank you, Corinne, for that.
Yeah,
feedback.
No. And I'm not saying that just because we're co-hosts and really good friends. It really is true that for me, I think, so let me go on a little bit of a tangent here. Like, I think in the US, the majority of people taking these types of exams, or the majority of people I met in the process, were not native English speakers. And I also think there, and I am not saying this to be xenophobic. I've confirmed this with a couple of working interpreters. Mm-hmm. There is at least some preference in the market for interpreters who are native English speakers, mm-hmm. Because the court reporter, I mean, this is getting really niche-y, but mm-hmm. basically the reason that you are there in court, or a lot of the reason that you are there in court is for the court reporter to record what you're saying in English when you're speaking on behalf of the defendant.
Right.
And the court reporters, who are largely native English speakers, definitely have some preference for people who are native English speakers, especially if you are not a native English speaker and you have a heavy enough accent that the court reporter has trouble understanding you. Mm-hmm. I do feel like it can be an issue. Like, there is this sort of odd thing, in the market that the majority of people are not native English speakers, but I do think that there is a bit of a preference, say, for example, when law firms hire you to do a deposition or something like that, mm-hmm. that a lot of times the court reporters themselves prefer native English speakers because they're easier to understand. I mean, I just think that's kind of a really interesting reality of the market.
Okay.
But going back to resources, so the European Union has a program called ORCIT, O-R-C-I-T, that stands for Online Resources for Conference Interpreter Training. I won't say a ton about that because you can look at it if you're interested, but it's a free program. And then there also is a private website called SpeechPool that's just, millions of people giving speeches that you can practice interpreting to.
That I know is in the book for sure, SpeechPool. Yep. I'm not sure if the other one is or not.
And then an idea I got from your book, Eve, that really helped me was I obsessively listened to French podcasts mm-hmm. about anything.
Right.
So I think one of the things that is really interesting about court interpreting, and one of the things that is very, very intimidating when you go to the exam, is on top of all of the legal terminology, you have the substance of the case.
Right, which is, could be anything.
You don't know.
It could be any subject matter, right? Yeah.
Literally, it could be shoplifting, domestic violence, murder, car accident. Mm-hmm. Like, you have no
idea. Civil case. Do they ever do it in civil cases, or maybe they don't? It's only criminal. I don't know.
No, I just interpreted for traffic court yesterday. So, okay. Yeah.
I was thinking more like, if someone sues you, would you, that would be, maybe you'd have to provide that on your own because it's civil, or?
Or doing depositions in lawyers' offices.
Okay,
or,
okay. Yeah. Because I was thinking that, especially that, it could be anything. It could be,
yes,
like fraud. It could be, I'm suing you because you didn't pay my house right, or whatever.
Right.
I mean,
copyright infringement.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, it could be. So that's one of the things that I think is super intimidating, especially when you go to the exam, is that you literally do not know, say on your simultaneous passage, where you have no time to pause or think about anything because it's simultaneous. Mm-hmm. You don't know until they press play, on the recording, what the subject matter of the case you're getting is mm-hmm. going to be. So a topic that, or idea that I got from your book was to work with French podcasts just about a whole range of topics. Mm-hmm. So I think, when you're so focused on like legal, well, like anything could be helpful. I mean, this could be like a slip and fall accident in a hair salon.
Right, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, for real.
Yeah.
So I did, with podcasts, I did shadow interpreting, which is, for anybody who isn't familiar with that term, that's where you just repeat after the speaker in the same thing, in the same language. Now, it sounds rudimentary, and I'll tell you, when I first started, I could not even shadow interpret a lot of native French speakers because they talk too fast. Mm-hmm. So I worked with that, doing shadow interpreting, and then ultimately simultaneous interpreting as well. Mm-hmm. And then I finally bought the non-language specific practice exam from the National Center for State Courts. I'll put that in the show notes also. And I administered that test to myself about, I don't know, 2 weeks before I took the exam. So altogether, I'd say all of those prep materials and the actual exams cost me probably $500 to $600. So I think that's about the smallest investment, because I think that if you retake the exam, you pay the oral exam was like either, I think it was either $300 or $350. And I think you pay the whole fee, even if you retake one section. So in total, if for anybody who's a stats person, I think I did about 400 hours of direct studying for the exam. Because like I said, I started about a year and a half in advance. But then on top of that, I also did tons of flashcards and little audio things. So another idea I got from your book, Eve, and again, I'm not saying this as I don't get a commission on Eve's book, but just that if you are a native English speaker, one of the things you need to do is just improve your overall speaking skills. And I got so many ideas from your book about that, Eve, especially okay. things that you can do in like the little slices of time that you tend to waste on Facebook, if you're me. So at the outset, one of my real struggles was that, as I said, I could not talk fast enough in French to keep up in simultaneous interpreting.
Okay.
So I did hours and hours and hours of shadow interpreting, just repeating after the speaker in the same language. So I would do that with native French speakers to improve my speaking speed. So I tried to work on that with every possible moment, like literally when my family went skiing, if I was the first one back to the car, which I usually am, I would sit there with my phone and shadow interpret a French podcast for 10 minutes. And I even kept a stack of flashcards on my placemat at our dining room table so that when I was eating breakfast, I could go through, you know, court terms in French or whatever. And then I think another thing that Athena really impressed upon me was to obsessively record myself while I was interpreting. So even though it is incredibly painful, I could go back and actually hear what I did wrong and what I either struggled with or just faked because I didn't know the word in French, so I made something up.
I mentioned that in the book too, which is not focused on prepping, just to clarify people, for the interpreter's exam, but just to improve your own speaking skills. And I did say the idea, like you said, because then you're hearing yourself as a third person in a way.
Yes.
So you can, you might think, oh, I can't pick it up. I just did it myself. It's myself correcting it. But you do hear so many of the things you did, because at that point you're listening to it in the recording. You're almost like a third party listening to yourself.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And especially like if you wait 2 days or something,
yeah.
If your memory is as bad as mine, you won't even remember.
I'd be like, oh, I did that. I mean, literally, right. I'm like, I wrote that email like 24 hours ago. I don't remember.
Right. So if you record yourself, so I have the Acebo set that comes on CD, like actual physical CDs. So part of the challenge was dredging up a Discman. My daughter actually had an old Discman that she used to listen to audiobooks on. So I revived that Discman. So I would listen to the CDs on the Discman and then record myself on my phone using the voice memo function. And then I would leave it for a couple of days, like you said, and go back to it. And then you really do have like fresh ears and you go like, oh, wow, that thing that I thought was great was horrible, or like in consecutive, I skipped an entire sentence or whatever.
Yeah, give yourself some space to it. Interesting. Exactly. Talking about the Discman, we had a French relative come over to see us last year, and I don't know if it's just him or was a thing, and he wanted to go retro and he wanted a CD player, and I was able to find him one, like a Target or something.
Right.
So if people want a disc player, you can get them, but it's kind of hard.
Yeah. Yeah. You know.
So, okay, cool. Yeah, that's super interesting. So now tell us a little bit about the actual test. So I know that you cannot discuss the actual subject matter of the test, which, you know, is understandable for those types of tests, and like with the ATA exam and all that kind of stuff is common.
Yeah.
But can you share any tips that our listeners might find helpful about the actual test?
Yeah, right. So unfortunately, I can't tell you specifically, I think what everybody wishes they knew is the subject matter of the cases that are on the actual test, which unfortunately I can't say. But a really good tip that Athena gave me was, with your practicing for the test, go out on a high note and then stop practicing about 2 days before you take the test. So I picked a dialogue from The Interpreter's Edge that I had really struggled with. So like the real test, I would say The interpreters, the level of the interpreter's edge is probably more geared towards people taking the federal exam in Spanish. That would be my sense. Because, for example, a lot of it has site consecutive and simultaneous, just like the state exam does and federal exam for that matter. But just be aware, I believe that the simultaneous for the state exam is 120 words per minute. And a lot of the simultaneous dialogues in Interpreter's Edge are much, much faster than that, which you do have to be able to do for the federal exam and, for that matter, in real life.
I was going to say, even though they don't require that, you might have to do that in real life.
120 words a minute is slower than most average citizens talk. It's definitely true.
And I'm sure it's way slower than I actually talk.
Yeah, I'd say, I don't know, you might even be more like 160 or, and they have, for anyone who would ever have to interpret someone like Eve, the interpreters.
I would try to slow down, but who knows when you get excited, right?
Yeah, the Interpreter's Edge has what they call the turbo supplement. It's literally called the turbo supplement that is all like the fastest speakers. Really? So, yeah.
I've actually had people tell me the other way around, like, over my life, even in French, you speak super fast.
Right. Yeah.
Because it's not necessarily, once you get proficient in a language, for me, it's not necessarily, it's not that it's a language, it's my personality.
Right. It's not language specific. Yeah. Just how you talk. Yeah. So about 2 days before the test, I picked a dialogue from Interpreter's Edge that I had really struggled with the first time, and I did it again with a big improvement, and then I quit there. Mm-hmm. Because just
you
for the record,
on that high note.
Yep. So, and then I didn't practice anymore until I went to the exam. So
like an athlete, you practice for the 10K or the marathon point, and then you don't practice for, you don't run after a certain point.
Exactly. So just for the record, I did actually cry over the Interpreter's Edge at least once.
Holly, you're making Corinne cry.
And because one time when I was talking to Holly, she said that she notices that some people like start twitching when they hear her voice. Because she's actually, if you do the English only version, she's actually on a ton of the dialogues. Yeah, she reads a lot of the dialogues. So I did actually cry over the Interpreter's Edge at least once over a passage that I just could not do. Mm-hmm. So the day of the test, get there really, really early. Make that day as stress-free as possible and just anticipate that the whole experience is going to be very anxiety provoking. So you want to focus on what you can control, which is, for example, like your state of mind about being rushed getting there. Don't do that.
I do want to add something about that. I don't know if people knew. It took me, I was just lazy, never got around to it, whatever, but it took me over 20 years in this industry to take the ATA certification exam, which I took last year, and I had that same approach because coincidentally, my mother and my sister were coming into town to visit that day, and they arrived, I could have gone and got them. And my husband said, do you want to get them before you go to the exam? And I said, no, are you crazy?
Yeah.
And so I just said, you go get them. I'll see them after it's all done. I won't have any stress. And I got there super, super early. I mean, it's a different thing, but kind of the same idea of that.
Yes.
And I had to drive across town. I wanted to get there super early in case something happened, blah, blah, blah. But I think, like you said, it's really important not to feel stressed from that kind of stuff where you're rushed.
Yeah, that's I think for anybody who's preparing for any translation or interpreting exam.
Or any professional exam, really. But.
Yes, exactly. So for example, I planned on getting there an hour before my test time, and I just took some like mindless podcasts and sat there and listened to them. Mm-hmm. But I just thought like the last thing that I want to be doing is like running, hyperventilating and sweaty.
It freaks me out thinking of it, yeah.
Right. I know when another person who gave me a lot of really good advice about the exam was Judy Jenner, because some of you may have read a post that she put on my blog. We could link to it too, about preparing for the federal court interpreter exam. Mm-hmm. And in her case, she actually, I believe they were giving the exam in a hotel and she stayed overnight in that hotel.
Oh, that's a great idea.
Yeah. The night before she booked a room in that hotel so that she had like zero worries about getting there. And I just think you want to think about, you know, when I thought like, how long have I spent preparing for this or thinking about it? Like for you, you know, you were a translator almost 20 years before you took the ATA exam, you know, and are you going to waste all of that on picking your mom and your sister up at the airport? No, like
I was like, nope, that was
you know, no. Or is it worth like $150 hotel room to not be stressed about getting there? You know, if they're administering the exam in a hotel. So
I just to clarify, so people know, my husband picked them up. They didn't have to walk.
You did not make them take Uber. Your husband,
but it wasn't going to be me.
Right, exactly. So you know, eliminate all stress and distractions on that day.
That you can control.
Yes, exactly. And just realize that there is going to be a ton of stress that you have no control over. So for example, when I took it, the person administering the exam, because you have to have, you know, a live person controlling the recordings, the person was sitting literally like 6 inches away from me at the same table. And even though I don't believe that she spoke any French, in the Colorado one, at least, it's just employees at the courthouse who administer it. But when you think about how stressful that is, having someone sitting literally so close that they could touch you while you're taking this exam because they're operating the recordings, that was stressful. And then
you have to get in the zone or something somehow.
Yes.
Yeah.
I actually like, I mean, even if this looked a little weird, I actually sort of shielded my eyes with my hand so that I couldn't see her. When I was interpreting, and I found it helpful as well, you know, not on site translation because you have to read it. I close my eyes when I'm doing it, you know, so that literally there are like no visual distractions and I'm focusing just on hearing. And on the Colorado exam, at least, you can't use headphones for the consecutive, which I found by far the hardest because you have no warning as far as what language the person is going to be speaking. Like you don't know whether they're going to speak English or French until that segment starts because it's a conversation going back and forth.
That was interesting because in real life you would know.
Right.
I mean, you know the person.
Yeah, sort of. I mean, people interrupt each other all the time. You have.
I mean, I know, but I mean, you'd know that like person A with the pink shirt is her native language is French, and the person
exactly.
with blue is going to. I get what you're saying, but it's a little bit not exactly like real world, but okay.
Right. So that I, you know, had sort of set myself up for mentally that consecutive is the part that I find the hardest anyway, and then you can't use headphones on the consecutive; they just play it through speaker. Whereas for me, like the simultaneous, I won't say that it's easy, but they do allow you to use headphones. And I find
it's closer to you somehow then too. I mean, it's in your ears as opposed to the other ambient noise and stuff.
Exactly. And it's easier to like shut out the distractions when you're wearing a headset. And then, you know, before I practiced interpreting myself, I always used to think it was crazy when people would say like simultaneous is so much easier because it's like rolling a ball down a hill. Like once you get in the groove, you just go with it. And I actually now totally believe that. Like, I found that totally, you know, the truth for myself that simultaneous is like cognitively simpler, I guess, because you're not remembering anything.
It's just coming out. Yeah, I've heard that too before.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So as I expected, I did the best on site translation because I think it's the most like written translation, which I've been doing for 16 years, then next best on simultaneous, and then the worst on consecutive, which I anticipated, but I did pass all three sections. So I think another great tip that Athena drilled into me, and it's so hard if you're a translator to force yourself to do this, when you don't know a word or you know that you made a mistake, just keep going because it's better than missing a whole sentence, which is what happens when you fixate on the missed word or the error. So you could even say something, have a word like thing that you say when you totally don't know a word.
You
know,
say the word thing you're saying.
Yes, yes, exactly. And that's something that I've heard experienced conference interpreters say that they do in practice. I mean, of course you don't do that when you're in a real assignment, but to mentally train themselves to just keep going, they'll practice with dialogues that have incredibly technical terms that they know they don't know, and they'll say something like skip, you know, to just key or thing or that, to just keep going. Because the interesting thing about the court interpreting exam, at least at the state level, is that it's based on what are called scoring units. So some words are literally not counted in the scoring, and some are. If it's a scoring unit, you just get, like, you got it or you didn't. That's how it's scored. You know, so you'll have your, you know, let's say in your simultaneous dialogue, you, or simultaneous passage, you might have 50 scoring units out of, you know, 400 words. I'm just pulling that out of the air. But all that matters is you get, you know, plus one for every scoring unit that you got and minus one for every scoring unit that you didn't get. That's how it's scored. So the thing that you have to train yourself for is that, like, statistically, the chance is that the word you missed was not a scoring unit. You know, I mean, the just in terms of numbers, the majority of words are not scoring unit. There's like one or two in every sentence. So statistically, the chance is that it was not a scoring unit and you just have to move on. So I think a lot of people put a lot of stress into what might be on the exam. And it's true that that's extremely stressful because you don't know the subject matter of the case until the recording starts playing. So another thing I would recommend is focus on the stuff that will definitely be on there that is in every single court case ever. So you've got individual words, judge, jury, plea, case, verdict.
The ones that they have to have that as a score.
Yes. Then you go to phrases. Ladies and gentlemen of the jury, you're innocent until proven guilty. Your guilt must be proven beyond a reasonable doubt. Definitely you need to know those. And then entire statements, like, say, the Miranda rights. You have the right to remain silent. Anything you can and say will be used against you in a court of law.
This is so, like, interesting, because this goes back to what you said earlier, in that those phrases don't exist in French, but you have to know how they want them translated. What am I saying? How they wanted them interpreted.
Exactly.
Because I assume that there is some standard way that has evolved in the U.S. system, in the Colorado system, or whatever, the Texas system, or the California system, for interpreting those specific phrases that are very culturally specific to the U.S., but there has got to be some standardized way, or maybe there's, I don't know, you can tell me if you know, there's the different ways that, maybe there's three different ways that are acceptable, but there's some ways that are not acceptable, and so that you have to get within that range or whatever of those. But it's super interesting because it's not culturally what you normally have.
So, you know, for example, like, you know, 90%+ of French court interpreters are going to interpret beyond a reasonable doubt as au-delà de tout doute raisonnable. You know, I mean, there might be people who would interpret it some other way. And like for court, they're not going to use cour, they're going to use tribunal, you know, stuff like that. So that's the thing, is that I think you need to really, really hone in on those and know them without even thinking about it in your non-English language.
It's just like my husband says, automatisme. It just happens automatically.
Yes.
Those ones, you don't want to waste your time having to think about those.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay, cool. Yep. That's super interesting.
I mean, if you're a language nerd, that is kind of really interesting.
So awesome. I did have another question for you that you may not know the answer to, but I was wondering, did they give you any feedback on, or have you heard in your research, who scores it or how is it scored?
So I don't know. I mean, when I got my scores, I got an email from the Colorado Judicial Branch that had my scoring sheet from the National Center for State Courts. So that's who scores it.
Oh, okay.
But I have
so
no idea.
Some national.
So yeah, the national.
I can sort them.
Exactly. The National Center for State Courts scores it. But as far as, I mean, the interesting thing is, like, even in, you know, 16 years of being a translator and being involved with ATA, I've never run into anyone who is a scorer or is a rater for the languages other than Spanish. Like, I know some people who are raters for have been raters for the federal exam, but not for French. So I have no idea who scored it.
But I'm actually very interested in asking that answer one of my questions, because I was thinking, not realizing that it was the consortium, because then it means they're scoring it for several states, you know, different states that belong to that. Because I was thinking, who would do in Colorado? Like you said, it's hard to not really have that many, for French anyway, and different, I'm sure for other languages, Romanian, Polish, whatever, so that they have the consortium do it because there's limited resources to score them, probably.
Exactly. Exactly.
So, okay, cool. Well, to wrap up, I want you to tell us, what have you been doing with this wonderful new credential since you earned it?
So here in Colorado, there is not a huge market for French interpreting, but there also are not a lot of people who do it. So right now there is, in terms of French court interpreters, there's me and one other person who is certified for French. So I've been interpreting for the Colorado State Courts, actually mostly traffic cases, mm-hmm. and some over the phone, which I know a lot of interpreters hate, but I find I really actually enjoy it because for whatever reason, I find it less stressful doing it remotely. Mm-hmm. So for example, I just did a traffic court case for a court on the other side of Colorado yesterday. And then I'm in the process of applying to local interpreting agencies. I've been contacted proactively by a couple of law firms that needed deposition interpreting, but those were over the summer when I was away. But here's a really interesting thing that I thought our listeners might be interested in. I've gotten two new law firms as translation clients. Mm-hmm. Because I'm currently the only person in Colorado who's ATA certified for French to English and court certified for French, which they seem to like, even though those of us in the profession would not see those as really overlapping. I feel like that's
just
fine.
Confirming again, so what you're saying, just because we're under the listeners, I see, you know, like I'm just thinking, you're saying you're ATA certified for French to English translation for translation.
Yep.
And then you're also court certified for French court interpreting, as we've been talking about through this whole episode.
Right.
But nobody else has those two certifications in Colorado.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And I think, you know how... Right. And you know how a lot of times, like if you have, you know, let's say clients who are used to the European system, mm-hmm. what they're looking for is a credential called sworn translator, which mm-hmm. is like a lot of European countries certify court translators, mm-hmm. not just interpreters, but certify people who can translate documents that are submitted to court. I think in some sense,
they're
U.S.
looking to replace that kind of.
Exactly. That what U.S. law firms are looking for, even though, again, most of us would not see court interpreting as a credential that applies to written translation, I will say that law firms seem to really like that. So,
yeah, and I can see that because they're saying like, okay, this other thing like you talked about, this foreign translator doesn't exist, but they need some kind of metric. So that's the metric they have. That's the metric they're going to use.
Exactly.
Yeah. So,
and then again, in terms of my, you know, work and future work, a huge shout out to the Colorado Judicial Branch. They treat their interpreters really, really well in terms of working conditions and also training that is available at an extremely low cost. Like they have a court interpreter training somewhere in the Denver area really like almost every month.
Wow.
So for example, last month I did a mock trial training mm-hmm. where they had court staff playing the parts of the people in a real case in a courtroom and we took turns interpreting and it was $5 for a half day.
Oh.
Yes.
So you're right, really cheap. I thought like, oh, $50 or
no.
So it's like they have to charge, but it's really basically free. Yeah.
Or to cover their administrative costs or whatever.
Yeah,
but their in-person trainings are so inexpensive that they're basically free. So keep it up, Colorado Judicial Branch. And for anybody else, see what's available in your state.
I do have another really quick question. Just
sure.
that it's interesting to me, because once in a while, you know, we'll all hear in the news, it'll blow up in the news and they'll say, you know, such and not that this would affect you personally, but I'm just saying in the court systems in general, like, oh, you know, someone used this court interpreter who wasn't qualified. And now all the cases this person worked on are being thrown out or whatever, because the defendants didn't get appropriate, you know, representation in essence, because the interpreting was bad. And so do they talk to you about, I'm just curious in orientation, do they talk to you anything about like liability or I don't know, or anything like that? What happens if you don't, not you personally, but if someone doesn't do a good job or whatever, that kind of stuff.
Right. Well, so a lot of what they talk about is, you know, adhering to the interpreter code of ethics. And part of that is staying within your abilities. Mm-hmm. And another thing I will say for the Colorado Judicial Branch is they do not start you out interpreting for trials. Like you are not going to get your certification and then the next week go start interpreting for trials, you know, by yourself. I mean, also for trial, here in Colorado, they use two people if it lasts more than 2 hours, and a trial is probably going to last more than 2 hours with another interpreter.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and then another thing that they really impress upon people is that when you know that you made a mistake, you just correct it for the record and move on. So you just say, you know, to the court reporter, the interpreter would like to make a correction for the record. You know, when I said January 12th, the defendant actually said January 2nd. Yeah, okay, exactly.
Okay.
So yeah, but, and I think also this, I mean, just on a, you know, sort of related topic, this is kind of the first time in my professional career that I do think I'm probably going to purchase professional liability insurance, because if I am interpreting, let's say, for a law firm, that's not covered by the court systems, you know, E&O insurance or anything like that. It's on me. And I do think that,
that's true. I can see that in a civil case where it's, that seems to me high pressure for getting.
Yes. Well, and I think as well, and this is something that, you know, interpreters talk about a lot, that for better or worse, until recording of events like that became commonplace, it was really just your word against theirs. Like, I don't know that something like that would have, you know, an interpreter error would have progressed a lot, because, you know, they heard what they heard and you heard what you heard, and it's one person's word against another's, whereas now almost all of that stuff is recorded.
Oh yeah. I mean, I mean, it's interesting they say that, because I, when I first started out my career when I was in my 20s, I worked at a law firm, and trust me, stuff was recorded back then, and that was,
yeah.
So yeah. I mean, that's true that it probably did change, but it's been like that for a while. And like depositions have been recorded for, you know.
Right.
Yeah.
But yeah, that's one thing that they have really impressed on us in all of those trainings is, like, even if you realize, let's say in a multi-day case, that you know you made a mistake, you know, earlier in the case, you go to the court reporter or the judge and correct the record.
Okay. Interesting. Well, cool. So this is super interesting to me too. Thanks, Karen. Because I kind of knew what you were doing in the background, but not all these interesting details, and I never have really researched it myself. And like, you know, it might be interesting to people too to think about, like, where you live. Is it something, because like for Corinne, people call, I was telling her before we started to record our episode today, is that people call me all the time asking me to do interpreting, not just court interpreting, but any kind of interpreting. And I say no, and I pass it on to someone else. And for court interpreting, like like I said, and for any kind of interpreting, there really aren't that many French people, for people who speak French in Colorado.
It's true. Yeah,
so, like you said, it's super interesting about how you got some other clients for translation, just as a side thing from that, which you wouldn't have thought of in advance. So
exactly.
So yeah, I hope it'll inspire any of our listeners who are preparing for this kind of interpreting exam themselves, or just like you said, just kind of how you go after and break down, you know, this kind of goal that you had that you know, did take dedication to on your side, you know, to just get it. And you didn't just go in like we see, you know, which I've seen throughout my career, and just different types of things where people say, oh, I'll just do that. I'll just take the exam.
Give it a try. Yeah no, don't do that.
Because for one, it's not really professionally responsible either. I mean, like, okay, maybe you'll slide through, probably not. But if you do, are you really prepared for that? So, you know, you also took it seriously as a professional and prepared in the way that you should prepare. So, yeah, that was super interesting. Thank you for talking about that today on this episode.
Sure. So thanks for interviewing me about it. And I hope it's helpful. And just a reminder to our listeners to subscribe to Speaking of Translation in Apple Podcasts or on Stitcher so that you will never miss an episode. Thanks for listening. And we will talk to you in a future episode.